claim that nearly 85% of the Muslim population in India is Pasmanda and only 15% belong to Peace Orders. The community has often tried to raise the issue of its socio-economic backwardness and cited the numerical majority among the Muslim. Still, a tiny elite section, Ashrafs, remain in the lead position. They claim that out of the roughly 400 Muslims elected in the first 14 lower house of parliament, only 60 were from the Pasmanda background.
Muslims have gone to some lengths to perpetuate the myth of a casteless or classless community. But facts remain on the ground as the same notion has now come to haunt them as they struggle to push their claim for reservation enshrined in the Indian constitution for the victims of the centuries-old Hindu caste system. The renewed debate on reservations, spurred with the introduction of a 10% quota for economically weaker sections, has led Muslims to revive their long-lasting demand for a share of the pie, arguing that theirs is amongst the economically most backward communities and therefore eligible to be included in the list.
After the recent victories in the state assembly elections, the BJP has intensified its groundwork to grab most votes in the civic elections. Political parties in Uttar Pradesh are all gearing up for urban local body polls in December. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in the state is planning a new experiment in these elections, which are being seen as the semi-finals for the 2024 parliamentary elections. The BJP, popularly known as Saffron Party, is said to have recruited thousands of Muslim leaders and activists from different class-based groups to help it with campaigning. They are going all out to win over Muslim voters, especially those categorized as the Pasmanda. A BJP source says there are 27 assembly segments in Gujarat where Muslim voters have a significant impact on the election outcome. The party, therefore, has concentrated its strategy on these assembly segments by using Muslim community leaders and workers to conduct door-to-door campaigning in Muslim-dominated neighborhoods. A party source says their task is to inform Muslim voters about the welfare schemes launched for them by the BJP government. The Muslim leaders are also attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party, which has so far been seen as anti-Muslim and hate-monger.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Razvi. He's a political commentator from London. First of all, welcome to the programme, Mr. Razvi. Now, after the big victory in the assembly elections, the BJP has now intensified its attempts with the civic elections. So what is the importance of this election for BJP and other parties?
BJP has been in power for the last 8 years, and they're hoping to sort of continue in power for the next 4 years when the general elections come up shortly. The situation is what you've got to look at is really well documented in what is called the Gujarat Files, anatomy of a cover-up by a famous Muslim journalist in India called Rana Ayub. And she really sort of shows how Narendra Modi and Amit Shah ascended in power and their journey from Gujarat to New Delhi. What they did back in the early 2000s, when there were huge massacre and program of Muslim killing in Gujarat. So they've used that as a template from Gujarat to really occupy the power, the central power in New Delhi. And they're using that, as I said, as a template to motivate the Hindu majority on a very sort of religious basis. And their former two victories have been basically, essentially based on that particular approach of dividing the Indian population into Hindus and Muslims.
So, Mr. Razvi, while the BJP government tries to woo Pasmanda or backward Muslims by welfare schemes, the Muslim leaders are attempting to dispel doubts and misconceptions about the party itself. So what are the roots of these doubts amongst the Muslim community?
Well, what you've got to look at is that Pasmanda Muslims, as I said, Indian society is a very caste-ridden society. You have the ruling elite, which comes from the Brahmin caste, which is perhaps 1%, 2% of the Hindu population, then you've got many stratas of Hindus who are lower caste or what are known as Harijans, the untouchables. Then you have what is, interestingly called the other backward class or classes, in which Pasmanda Muslims are also included, because they are, by definition, not in the Hindu caste system because they're Muslims, but also because they have been impoverished, poor, and sort of in occupations which are seen as to be demeaning for ordinary other people. So effectively, 51, for example, in a state like Bihar, which is in the eastern part of India, over 50% of the population is deemed to be other backward classes, which includes Hindus and Muslims. So it's a sort of a very complex political voting bank structure, if you like. In the past, the Congress Party, which used to rule India for the good 30 years after the partition in 1947, also relied on the Muslim vote. So what the BJP is now trying to do, I suspect, is trying to row these Pasmanda Muslims from the poor and the lower classes to vote for them, because they've been offering them certain incentives and other benefits, which could sort of give BJP that leverage in getting the Muslim vote as well from these particularly deprived classes in India.
Mr. Razvi, like you said, in the 1990s, we saw the rise of several social movements that gave voice to and a new direction to abolish class or caste-based hierarchy in the Muslim society. So the question is, why have these movements become faint and silent today?
It's an interesting question. Effectively, in Islam or in Muslims, there is supposed to be no caste system. However, there are elitist Muslims, well-off Muslims, educated Muslims, up and down the country from north to the south, east to the west. As you know, India is a huge country with a population of about 1.4 billion. So in that, you would have some wealthy Muslims. What has happened, sadly, if you like, is that some of the very wealthy Muslims themselves, whether they live in New Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, Calcutta, they have tended to actually turn a blind eye to their own Muslim brethren at times.
Before we let you go, sir, the BJP government has decided to enter the Muslim question not from the top but from the bottom, through Dalits, OBCs and tribals. So what are the effects of this strategy on the unity of Muslims in India?
Well, that's a very difficult question. One would have to really see what happens at the elections, but I'm sure they will make some inroads into the poor community because, as I said, the other backward classes, the OBCs, if you like, and Muslims, some of the poor Muslims fall in that category. Therefore, the incentives and the sweetness that are being offered to poorer Muslims, if you like, will sway some of them to vote. But I think the strategy in the medium to long term, but in the short term, it may be effective, but I think medium to long term, the Muslim political elite will realize that it's in their interest also to be working together with their less well-off Muslim brethren, Muslim community, so that they are not swayed by BJP at this moment.
There you have it, Mr. Shabir Razvi, a political commentator from London. It's always good to have you with us, Mr. Razvi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Relatively orderly posted, Rajnath Singh reaches out to Muslims, says BJP ready to apologize for past mistakes. Pallavi Ghosh says, will Muslims vote for the BJP in 2024 as BJP reaches out to them?
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In early October, Bangladesh suffered from a grid failure that triggered a blackout across 75 to 80% of the country. This latest development is a mere indicator of the looming power crisis in Bangladesh, where long power cuts and load shedding have become common occurrences. The intermittent electricity supply has impacted key export industries, which are crucial for bringing in much-needed foreign exchange. This crisis also threatens to push Bangladesh into a cycle where it will be unable to secure enough energy imports due to a shortage of foreign reserves, having long-standing strategic implications with its energy partners.
A combination of global and domestic factors has led Bangladesh to the present crisis. Close to 85% of the nation's electricity is generated using fossil fuel like natural gas and oil, with the former being the primary source. An exponential rise in oil and gas prices due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the decision by the OPEC Plus to reduce oil output, and the European Union sanctions on the Russian energy sector has resulted in surging inflation and unsustainable energy import bills. Thus, Bangladesh has also been compelled to stop gas purchases and shut down its several diesel-run power plants. Dhaka's scant attention to renewable energy and policies like capacity payments has exacerbated the energy crisis there. Until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest-growing economy in the region. A core part of its success has been the ready-made garments industry, which makes up more than 10% of its GDP and employs around 4.5 million people. Today, Bangladesh is the world's second-largest garments exporter, and the RMG sector accounts for 84% of its exports, playing a crucial role in the country's foreign reserves. However, the current crisis has slowed down the industry, with many factories reporting a fall-off in production by 50%. Daily power outages lasting around 3 hours on average have been one of the main contributors to this trend.
For Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. Each of its key energy partners comes with a caveat. With Russia, it's the possibility of further attracting Western pressure, unpredictability, and rising costs of doing business. Reliance on China raises questions about reliability, an unsustainable debt, and also disrupts the brewing relationship with India and the US. Undoubtedly, the US comes with expertise and financial capabilities, but lacks commitments and therefore is not yet capable of countering Russian and Chinese cooperation with Dhaka. Finally, despite technical and financial limitations, India comes with the potential for energy connectivity and trade.
Dhaka faces an uphill task of securing additional gas supplies, rapidly diversifying electricity mix to meet its green energy pledges, and continuing the dynamic economic growth. Shift towards prioritizing long-term energy security requires a careful balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another. China and Russia have traditionally been vital partners for Bangladesh's energy sector. Today, 90% of the energy projects in Bangladesh's pipeline are funded by China. On the other hand, Moscow has helped Bangladesh with gas exploration and drilling. It has also extended nuclear cooperation by building Bangladesh's first power plant. China and Russia's increasing energy cooperation with Dhaka have compelled the United States to step up its cooperation to be a credible energy partner for Dhaka and counter its reliance on Russia and China. Acknowledging the growing extra-regional footprint in Bangladesh, India is also ramping up its energy cooperation with Dhaka. Revitalized dialogue channels within Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, and Nepal for regional cooperation in energy can provide Bangladesh access to cheap and clean energy from Nepal and Bhutan as well. This cooperation allows Bangladesh a long-term solution for its growing power demand and could help reduce its reliance on fossil fuels by tapping the vast hydropower potential of the neighboring Himalayan nations.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed. He's a director for Center for Muslim Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, for Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. How can Dhaka use the situation, balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another?
I think the issue that Bangladesh has is a short-term and a long-term one. And, that in the short term, like in other parts of the world, the energy crisis is going to be very difficult and challenging, as you say, to deal with. Because of the increase in prices, the capacity of Bangladesh has been really the fact that they don't have enough reserves to pay for the extra cost rise that's taken place around the world. And they've been dependent on mainly Russia and China for their gas and Qatar for their needs, both petrol and also the gas mainly. And this has meant that the West is sanctioning those two countries, and therefore the supply has decreased, demand is still there, and prices have gone up. So this is a difficult environment for them to navigate. It means they have to look elsewhere as well.
Mr. Mohammed, until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest growing economy in the region. What are the main effects of Bangladesh energy crises can have on the regional economy?
Well, obviously, the demand for energy is still the same and increasing, but the supply of energy has been reduced, and that means that the cost has also increased. And for countries with a fragile sort of balance of reserves in their accounts, it means that they're having to pay a lot more to buy the energy that they need for the country. And that means their reserves are plummeting, which affects their whole economic situation. And secondly, of course, if you're having load shedding and power cuts during the day a number of times, then the capacity of business and local people to continue their economic life is affected. So naturally, growth will be affected.
Mr. Mohammed, for Bangladesh, regional cooperation in energy with Bhutan, India and Nepal can provide it with access to cheap and clean energy. So what factors prevent Dhaka from this cooperation?
Obviously India is also under pressure not to trade with Russia. So trading and working with India, which leads this regional cooperation effort, also means getting close to Russia, but Bangladesh itself is a major has China as its major trading partner, and particularly in the energy sector, and they have debts to China, loans to China, and of course China and India are economic rivals, but also political enemies over the Kashmir issue and many other issues. India is a part of the alliance with the West, AUKUS, and other alliances against China.
Last but not least, Mr. Mohammed, with the winter and a cap on Russian fuel imports approaching, European buyers will look to stock up even more LNG. So what are the consequences of this European action for developing countries like Bangladesh, and what can these countries do to get out of this condition?
Well, obviously the sanctions will remain on Russia and on China as well. Iran is also sanctioned, so you know that's taken out of the market. There's the Europeans are looking for alternative sources for their own supplies, including the United States, which has a lot of LNG, and Qatar, which also does. But that will take a long time, you know, a couple of years to be able to meet the demand from Europe. So not only the developing world, but European countries are also going to suffer in this energy crisis, because supply is going to be restricted and demand is still the same and increasing.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Mohammed for being on the program. He's a director at the Center for Muslim Affairs in Manchester. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Avex Chemicals India tweeted, Bangladesh needs political willpower because there's high corruption. That's why the country is going through an economic crisis. Bangladesh needs economic reforms if they want to save the nation. India really cares about Bangladesh. Hope Prime Minister Hasina G does the same. Lalit Singh Mehta writes, Bangladesh raised petrol prices by 52% in one day. 52% rise. People on streets protesting. Bangladesh going to IMF with begging bowl as economic crisis mounts. Shops locked after 8 p.m. to save energy. 13-hour daily power cut. All expert fans of Bangladesh economy suddenly silent. Sohail Khan says, half a worth reading article. Bangladesh and India grew in past two decades while Pakistan economy didn't grow, mainly due to war on terror, power sector crisis and poor policies. Now as Pakistan has controlled terrorism, inshallah Pakistan will grow and will compete neighbors in 2040.
And that was our episode about the dual policy of the Indian government towards religious minorities and the Bangladesh power crisis and its strategic implications. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
While millions of Americans lack adequate health coverage, the Pentagon has a new nuclear bomber to flaunt. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Common Dreams, peace and economic justice advocates responded to the imminent unveiling recently of the United States Air Force's new $750 million per plane nuclear bomber by reiterating accusations of misplaced priorities in a nation where tens of millions of people live in poverty and lack adequate healthcare coverage. Military-industrial complex giant Northrop Grumman is set to introduce its B-21 Raider. The B-21, whose development was 30 years in the making and whose total project cost is expected to exceed $200 billion is tapped to replace the aging B-2 Spirit. One thing the world definitely does not need is another stealth bomber, Vidya Benjamin, co-founder of the peace group Codepink, told Common Dreams. Benjamin added, "This ominous death machine, with its price tag of $750 million a pop, brings huge profits to Northrop Grumman, but takes our society one more step down the road of a spiritual death." Referring to Rev. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1967 anti-war speech, saying, "Beyond Vietnam, a time to break silence," in which the civil rights leader called the U.S. government the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Noting the B-21's impending introduction, Canadian professor Christopher Stonebanks tweeted recently, "Hey, how's the good old USA doing on free healthcare, eliminating poverty, and accessible education for all? What? Oh, I see. They have a new stealth bomber. Okay, and their citizens are good with that trade-off?" The Pentagon, which recently failed its fifth consecutive annual audit, is slated to get $847 billion in 2023 after Congress rubber stamps the next National Defense Authorization Act, possibly as soon as this month. That's more than the combined military spending of China, India, the UK, Russia, France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Japan, and South Korea, according to the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS. Meanwhile, CNBC reported, most American workers dream of a comfortable retirement, yet many find their money falls short of meeting that goal when they reach their golden years. Much of the problem has to do with how the retirement system has evolved. Pension plans that used to guarantee a stream of post-career income from employers have given way to 401k plans and other retirement accounts that put the responsibility on workers themselves to save. Recently, private and public industry leaders came together in Washington, D.C. at an event hosted by the Employee Benefits Research Institute to identify ways to better help workers avoid a shortfall. U.S. Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh recalled how his father, a construction worker, retired with a pension, an annuity that has enabled his mother to remain financially stable when he died. "There are too many Americans who don't have that future stability," Walsh said. "Having a retirement plan is an essential component of a good job," he added. Yet many Americans don't have any retirement savings or plan at all, and many of those workers are approaching the end of their working careers, Walsh said. For people of color, the situation is even more dire, he noted. Just 36% of black households ages 55 to 64 have any retirement savings, and that number goes down to 30% for Hispanic households. Those that do have savings often have very little set aside, according to Walsh. "This is a crisis that we have to address in the United States of America," Walsh said. As many as 57 million Americans lack access to a workplace retirement saving plan, said Ed Morphy, president and CEO of Empower, a provider of retirement services. Morphy said, "We know that if people aren't covered by workplace savings, they don't save. If they don't access through payroll deduction, they just flat out don't save." Employers that do not offer retirement plans include small businesses like daycare centers, hair salons, auto shops, and restaurants that are just trying to make it work, Walsh noted. The lack of retirement plan coverage presents an opportunity for the financial industry and government to work together to find solutions, Walsh said. For too long, the message to workers has been you're not saving enough, and that may be true, but that's certainly not the whole story. California is one of a handful of states that has implemented automatic individual retirement accounts to help bridge that gap for workers who lack access to retirement plans through their employers. The program called CalSavers opened in 2019 to employers with five or more employees. Those that opt out are required to begin offering their own retirement plan per California rules. CalSavers is seeing positive results, according to Katie Selensky, executive director of the program. About 65% of employees who are automatically enrolled in the program stay in.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. president said on Thursday that he would be willing to speak to Vladimir Putin if he truly wants to end the war. That was the first time he had expressed willingness to speak with the Russian leader since the beginning of the war in February, around which time he said that he will not be speaking with Putin. He made his comments as he was delivering a speech at a joint White House news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron. Here's what he said about the war in Ukraine and the unrealistic conditions under which he would speak to Putin.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin is, I choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin. If, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet.
Biden further added, if that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he has in mind, as he and Macron vowed long-term support for Ukraine. The Kremlin took note of Biden's comments and responded through its spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said that Putin remains open to negotiations, but he is not going to pull his troops out of Ukraine. Peskov emphasized another unrealistic condition that Biden had set for talking with Putin. That would be the West's refusal to recognize the quote-unquote new territories that Russia annexed during the controversial September referendums. All that said, Peskov was not dismissive of the potentiality of talks between the two superpowers. While outlining Russia's conditions for the talks, he said, President Putin has been, is, and remains open for contacts for negotiations. Of course, the most preferable way to achieve our interests is through peaceful diplomatic means. While it is difficult to assess both parties' actual willingness to talk, what is objectively true is the fact that President Biden had not expressed any willingness to sit down with Putin with or without the unrealistic conditions he set. Could it be that the very difficult winter ahead of Ukraine and the rest of Europe is making the West reconsider negotiating with Putin? While President Biden was playing fast and loose with the idea of holding peace talks and simultaneously setting unrealistic prerequisites for it, President Macron expressed a more dovish tone by simply saying, I will continue to talk to President Putin. as he called for efforts, quote, to prevent escalation and to achieve concrete results. Macron also stated that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also shown, quote-unquote, real willingness to pursue peace. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke with President Putin on the phone and urged the Russian leader to find a diplomatic solution to the war as soon as possible. Scholz also called for the Russian troops to fully withdraw from Ukraine, an unlikely scenario to unfold. Putin told Scholz on the phone that Germany and the entire Western Bloc's approach towards Ukraine was destructive, as he called on Scholz to rethink his approach. It is unclear whether or not Germany, France, or the U.S. would initiate peace talks with Russia, but it seems that, at the very least, they are leaving the option on the table, despite some major disagreements between the two sides on the prerequisites for the talks. Something that was expected to hurt the potentiality of peace talks, but doesn't seem to now, is the price cap that was going to be imposed on Russian oil by the G7, EU, and Australia. They have, in fact, imposed the price cap at $60 per Russian crude oil barrel, but the amount is actually well above what Russian oil is trading for right now. This means that Russian oil will still flow, and that the West has not been able to find an alternative source to Russian oil, as Russia is still the major oil provider for the countries setting the price cap. The chair of Russian Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, believes that the price cap will only end up jeopardizing EU's energy security as the world waits to see how Russia will react to the move.
The UN General Assembly has voted in favor of a pro-Palestinian resolution to commemorate the Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, which marks the Israeli regime's claiming existence in 1948. The Assembly adopted the resolution with 90 votes in favor, 30 negative votes, and 47 abstentions. The initiative was sponsored by Egypt, Jordan, Senegal, Tunisia, Yemen, and the Palestinians, and was approved despite the opposition of the US, UK, and Israel, and most European Union countries. 47 states abstained. The UN resolution calls for a, quote, commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, including by organizing a high-level event at the General Assembly Hall in May 2023. The resolution also urges the dissemination of relevant archives and testimonies. Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, falls on May 15 of each year. The date commemorates events that led to the Israeli regime forcibly expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes in order to make way for the Israeli settlers 74 years ago.
Regrettably today, in the absence of a just solution, 75 years since the General Assembly's decision to partition historic Palestine with the adoption of Resolution 181 Roman II and the prolongation of Israel's occupation, now for over 55 years, the Palestinian people, including the Palestine refugees, continues to experience increasing levels of dispossession, displacement, violence, human rights violations, and insecurity.
The General Assembly also adopted other resolutions on the question of Palestine. They called for an immediate halt to settlement activities, land confiscation and home demolitions, the release of prisoners, and an end to arbitrary detentions.
The ongoing expansion of by Israel by the occupying power of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and the attendant settler violence, which is also on the rise, need decisive action. These illegal actions constitute grave breaches of international law and are a flagrant obstruction of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination.
Separately, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution regarding the Syrian Golan Heights, which the Israeli regime has been occupying for more than half a century. The resolution has demanded the withdrawal of the regime from that area. It called on Israel to implement the resolutions of the Security Council and to withdraw from the Golan to the line of June 4, 1967. On Thursday, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a raid near the city of Jenin in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Before raiding Jenin, Israeli forces attacked the town of Yabad, southwest of Jenin, and killed a 22-year-old man there. This is not an isolated act of violence against Palestinians. Israeli occupation forces have ramped up military activity in the West Bank, killing more Palestinians during the past months. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. That is the highest record of killings since the year 2006.
In 2022, we have witnessed a dangerous escalation in Israeli military raids across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, leading to the killing and injury of more civilians, including women and children.
And none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes. This is a clear indication how the policy of the coming Israeli cabinet will be: more killings and more aggression.
Israeli officials have described the security situation in the occupied West Bank as dangerous. They've even suggested that the regime could face another intifada or uprising. Palestinians have vowed to respond against Israel's acts of aggression. On November 23, two separate explosions rocked two bus stations at the entrance of occupied Al-Quds. The blasts were in response to a long period of ongoing Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people. The tensions come as Israel is about to have one of the most extreme right-wing cabinets in the coming weeks. The cabinet, which is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, is controversial due to the controversial Israeli politicians who have been mired in corruption and controversies. France and the United States are considered longtime allies with lots of cultural commonalities. But when it comes to trade, there are signs that the two longtime allies are heading for a confrontation. The French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting the United States on an official visit to boost ties. But during his trip there, Macron had some tough words directed against Washington for what he described as U.S. protectionism for its own industries. Emmanuel Macron is warning that the newly announced U.S. industrial subsidies could split the West. Macron arrived in Washington on Tuesday for his second state visit to the U.S. since taking office in 2017. French officials say Macron will confront President Joe Biden over the subsidies contained in the Inflation Reduction Act. The controversial act was signed by President Joe Biden back in August, and the Biden administration signed that with the Democratic-controlled Congress in a bid to boost U.S. domestic production and create more jobs there.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
Well, things started really well off with Joe Biden. There was a lot of, you know, handshaking and shoulder rubbing. And we're in this together and extremely friendly relations until AUKUS. AUKUS, obviously, was lived in France like a major betrayal. And it was painful, and nobody tried to hide, you know, how feelings were hurt.
France is not the only European nation to complain about the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Many European leaders have also complained about the legislative package. They say the package unfairly disadvantages non-American companies and would be a serious blow to their economies. The legislation could potentially be disastrous for car makers, especially in Germany and in France. Berlin and France have warned that if Washington does not scale back, they will introduce countermeasures against the United States. European leaders are mulling over the idea of a Buy European Act, just like the Americans. Germany, which is considered the EU's economic powerhouse, has also supported the French calls for more protection for European businesses and manufacturers. There are now talks of countermeasures similar to the U.S. scheme if Washington refuses to address key concerns. Brussels has made it clear that the U.S. legislation to subsidize its own businesses at the expense of its European partners represents a form of economic protectionism that undermines the rules of the World Trade Organization. The controversial act in the Biden administration comes after 4 years of rocky relations between the U.S. and Europe during the tenure of the former President Donald Trump.
Well, during the Trump presidency, the European-American, the French-American relation was quite conflictual and difficult, because in the White House was a president who didn't believe in alliance, who undermined NATO every step of the way, even talked about, you know, NATO being obsolete, and there was, according to him, a need to move on. He stepped out of the climate agreement on climate. He stepped out of a negotiation on the Iran nuclear program. Everybody remembers that Emmanuel Macron tried to soften somehow Donald Trump, and that it didn't work out.
Furthermore, on the U.S.'s discriminatory policies against the EU are seen as particularly harmful at a time when the world faces an economic slowdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Ukraine war, and trade bottlenecks. It is now believed that the U.S. is using the war in Ukraine to its own advantage by imposing its will on the EU.
Last week, the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Germany and Iceland to discuss alleged human rights violations in Iran during the handling of recent riots in the country. The intergovernmental body voted to establish an independent international fact-finding mission to investigate the purported abuses. In reaction, Tehran has dismissed the move. Iran's foreign ministry said the country will not cooperate with the mission, stressing that it has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into the events. Spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks at a press briefing in the Iranian capital of Tehran as he showed up with a chemical mask in the presser, which alluded to Germany's support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. Kanani lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based council, saying Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weapons to the former Iraqi Ba'ath regime during the 1980s war with Iran. Official reports indicate that in 1980, under the rule of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, Baghdad purchased over 1,000 tons of mustard agents from the West. Germany, the US, the UK, Italy, and the Netherlands were among the countries providing the Ba'athist regime with equipment and material to build chemical weapons. Over 350 large-scale chemical attacks on Iran-Iraq border between 1980 to 1988 on soldiers and civilians left Iran with more than 100,000 victims. Tens of thousands died on the spot, and many more suffered for years as a result of exposure to chemical agents. Elsewhere in his remarks, the spokesman of Iran's foreign ministry underlined that several United Nations reports have pointed to the fact that German companies were supplying the former Iraqi regime with chemical weapons. Kanani also condemned the hasty employment of human rights mechanisms and instrumental use of them against independent states, emphasizing that such an approach will not provide any help for the advancement of human rights. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned German ambassador to Tehran after the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Berlin and passed a resolution against the Islamic Republic. The ministry conveyed Tehran's strong protest against the interventionist and baseless statements of German authorities to the ambassador. Tehran denounced the recent passage of an anti-Iranian resolution at the UN Human Rights Council over the recent developments in Iran as a wrong measure founded on a completely politicized and instrumental approach to human rights, which is categorically rejected. The collaboration of Germany and certain European countries with the unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. has resulted in violation of the human rights of Iranians and strips them of any legitimacy and competence to make claims about human rights advocacy. Earlier in November, Tehran summoned the German ambassador over interventionist and irresponsible comments by the European country's head of state, Olaf Scholz, in support of the recent Western-instigated riots in Iran. Tehran blames foreign provocations for the riots in the country, saying it has provided evidence to countries whose nationals were involved in inciting unrest. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security forces, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Earlier in the month, Iran's intelligence ministry said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the recent riots, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Zionist regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. The European Union and some Western countries imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran, in turn, announced retaliatory sanctions against institutions and individuals in the European Union due to their deliberate actions in support of terrorism and terrorist groups during the riots.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Leaders meeting with Basij volunteer forces. On Saturday, 26th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of members of the Basij volunteer forces at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of views expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Saturday, 26th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of members of the Basij volunteer forces in Tehran. The leader greeted the Basij volunteer forces by saying, "Welcome, my dear brothers and sisters. You are the young, brave members of the Basij. You have illuminated our Hosseiniya with the Basij spirit that exists within you. Praise God. I would like to congratulate you and all the people of Iran on the occasion of Basij Week." The Basij was one of Imam Khomeini's greatest initiatives. He announced the establishment of an army of 20 million in the country in his famous speech in November of 1979. Basij volunteer forces were established in 1979 after Imam Khomeini's announcement. The blessings of the Basij and this great initiative were so great that Imam Khomeini delivered that outstanding, eloquent speech in praise of the Basij volunteer forces in November of 1988. I will quote a few of Imam Khomeini's eloquent sentences so that you may remember that our dear Imam addressed the Basij in that speech in the same way that a father would express his love for his children. The Imam said, "The Basij are a school of love and an academy of anonymous martyrs who chanted the call to martyrdom and bravery from its lofty minarets. This is splendid discourse, what excellent phrases," the Imam said. "The Basij are a fruitful tree whose blossoms spread the aroma of springs joining together, the freshness of certainty and the story of love." Imam Khomeini went on to say, "I take pride in being a Basiji myself. I would like to kiss the hand of every single one of you." These were the truly unforgettable words of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. You, members of the Basij today, are being addressed by this statement. Imam Khomeini did not say the Basij of the 1980s, he said members of the Basij. You and all future generations were being addressed by the late Imam. May God bless his soul. In further remarks, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "In his statement of November 1988, Imam Khomeini announced the importance of establishing a Basij for university and seminary students. There is a special meaning behind this. He told the university students and the students of religious sciences to have Basij groups and to be mobilized. This means that Basij is not just a military organization and that Basij should be present in all fields, including in sciences and in religious studies." The leader went on to ask, "What is Basij?" "Basij is a culture, it is a discourse. Basij is a way of thinking. What is this way of thinking? What is this culture?" "This culture means serving society and the country without any pretense or expectations. This is very important. It means serving without any expectations, without waiting to be praised, and in many cases, without receiving any funds or provisions to do something. After all, every movement requires provisions, but they enter various fields without such things. They serve selflessly and accept the risk of their service in the path of the Almighty. This is the Basiji culture." "But what is the meaning of Basiji culture? It means going into mud up to your knees to remove the mud from houses that have been flooded. It means putting yourself at risk of getting infected with COVID and risking your own life to save the lives of people suffering from COVID. Basiji culture means never getting tired when helping others. Basijis do not wait for others to praise them and to say well done. They provide this valuable service throughout the country. The Basijis have been successful in science, research and the laboratories. These were young people who worked in the fields of science and research, and there were those who had Basiji spirit or worked in laboratories, whether it was for COVID or for other issues. Our nuclear martyrs are an example of this. They were Basijis. Another example is the late Dr. Said Kazemi, who established the Royan Research Institute for Stem Cell Research and Genetics Research. This is the culture of the Basij. When facing the enemies on the battlefield, they are fearless. The Basiji culture is one that has been built by self-effacing, hard-working volunteers, as stated by the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. It is a culture of humble, undaunted fighters. It is about serving all the people. It is about serving the country. It means making sacrifices for others and even being oppressed in order to save the oppressed. Turning to recent events in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "You saw how in recent events in the country, the Basijis were the ones being oppressed while protecting the Iranian people from oppression of a group of